just ask questions. Okay, that's it. Because
gamers
do not care about what you have to say at all, anyway, you know? And all they want to do is talk about themselves. So you're just going to let them do that. Okay? So remember, questions, be cool.
Welcome to the Objective Secure Podcast. My name's Mike.
Hi, I'm Emma.
This is episode 24, Ask a TO, and I'm going to tentatively subheading this part one, because we're going to get other questions, I'm sure, from listeners and other attendees.
Yep,
and
we've got four questions here, but we are going to get through these in an hour.
We are. We're going to certainly aim for that. So part one refers to the fact there will be more of these in the future, not that this is part one of
two
or three or four, like usual. So before we get into those questions, though, and we sort of cover why and who and how and what, we might as well have a quick look at what's been going on hobby-wise over the last couple of weeks since we put our last episode out. Work-wise for us has been focused purely on show.
That's it.
Working on the new show bag in particular.
Which is an absolute nightmare. If we pull this off, it's going to be awesome, and if we don't, I'm going to cry.
So. Well, you have to do it in a corner somewhere where no one can see you.
I'll cry after the event, so it's all good. But I'll post photos.
Oh, look, we might even get video if we're lucky. Yeah, it's been all prep for shows, like 7 weeks or something now. So we've been trying to get all the players' packs finalised and up and published and finalising
everything. We're trying to finalise everything.
Yeah, pretty much. It's probably an easier statement than trying to list it all off, I guess.
I think trying to run any event is bigger than anyone who's not a TO can possibly imagine. Trying to run this many event games and retailers and workshops, and it's just mind-blowing how big it is and how much needs to be organised and done.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, look, and I don't think it can be underestimated just how much work does go into any planning for any event, and I think that's part of the reason why we're going to do this topic today, because these questions did come from an attendee of one of our events, and we're big on transparency in regards to how we make decisions and what goes on behind the scenes for events. So yeah, these are good questions for us to cover in an episode today. What else? We've had Adeptus Titanicus announced. That was up for pre-order on Saturday.
Yep.
The $490 Australian for the Grandmaster Edition was a deal breaker for a number of people that I'm aware of and know. It was for me as well. The fact that we're paying nearly a third more than the equivalent UK product when you do the direct exchange rate, you know, it's a hard one to justify, in my opinion. I know lots of people have gone, oh, you know, these are amazing models and it's a new cast and it's all everything else. Yep, I get all of that. The problem I have is that they're charging so much for a box set that, when compared to other box sets of a similar contents, have come in the mid-200s. And they've almost doubled it for Australia.
Mid-200s to 490 is doubled, yeah.
I mean, the best example I can give is the Imperial, not Imperial Knights, the Warhammer 40,000 Knights Renegade box game, which is two Imperial Knights, a set of terrain, and then the rules to play, obviously, Renegade as a Knight v Knight combat game. That came in, I think it was I want to say 265, somewhere around that sort of number anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The new Warlord Titans for Adeptus Mechanicus are smaller than the Knights, but they're pretty close. You get terrain, then you get six of the epic Adeptus Titanicus Knights, which are apparently the size of a Terminator, and then the rule books and the cards and everything like that. You've essentially doubled the cost for what is probably less than $100 of extra gear thrown into the box. And I know they're new sculpts and they have to recover costs, and it's a Forge World product, not a Games Workshop product, but it's hard to justify that sort of expenditure. And what's even more surprising is those Grandmaster editions, now that they're gone, the individual box sets are going to be more expensive. It goes up by another $100 to buy it all individually.
Mm, wow.
And when you start, like, all the stuff I've read about it says that the expectation of the game is that you're going to have 3 to 5 Titans plus Knight support for your own army. Now, if those Warlord Titans are $180 each, I'm going to assume that the Reaver Titans are going to come in around sort of 120, 130, something like that. And the Warhounds will probably come in pairs for, you know, sub $100. The Knight, the 3 packs of Imperial Knights will probably be in the $70 to $80 range. Which means that I'm going to have to fork out between $500, $600, $700 to get what they consider to be an army for this game. Which I can do a 40k army for that.
Which is a fair few more models than...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a really tough one. And the fact that it doesn't match any existing models, it's only for this game. There's no multi-use for it. It doesn't match the old Epic scale either, which is even more frustrating because at least if they match the old Epic scale, you could use them for that.
Yeah. I'm finding it interesting seeing all of these additional releases that they're doing. And I know that another one's just been announced. But I'm just finding it really interesting that they've got obviously their two main core games, so you've got Age of Sigmar and 40k, but then they seem to be releasing so many side games.
Well, these specialist games
seem to be coming really quite quickly.
Yeah, and the specialist games was something that Forge World had already announced they were going to be the ones supporting going forward, which kind of ties into why we've seen so many products discontinued, I believe. It's only my opinion, but I think that kind of speaks for itself in regards to what's been going on. But with what have we got? We've got Necromunda, Blood Bowl, now Adeptus Titanicus. I can't help but think it's only a matter of time before something like Battlefleet Gothic returns. And there'll be other Mordheim potentially, or a version of Mordheim for Age of Sigmar at least. The fact that the Necromunda releases essentially every quarter and the Blood Bowl one I think is something similar. And obviously Forge World are now producing plastic models, which is great, and hopefully that'll mean that we're going to get some bigger kits in plastic going forward. But I think they're almost shooting themselves in the foot trying to do what they're doing, because if they'd released all of the core 8 gangs for Necromunda in the space of 3 months instead of one new game, there are plenty of guys out there. I mean, I'm fortunate my favourite gang was the Vansar, which I think was the 4th gang released. And they've announced the Cawdor for gang 5, but I know plenty of people love the Dalak or...
And the thing is that by the time those ones come out, you've lost the hype.
Yeah.
Whereas if they'd done everything at once, you can go, oh, you know, I love those ones, go out, grab it, and you can be playing it, as opposed to, I need to wait 3 months or, you know, 2 years for my choice to come out.
Well, I saw as well someone say, you know, why hasn't it done the same thing to Blood Bowl? Why have we not seen the Blood Bowl side of things fall away? And I think that's partly because the fan community kept it alive for so many years independently
with
third-party miniatures available. So when they released the new box game, it was like, oh, I want to play elves. Well, that's cool. There are a dozen different elf teams on the market you can buy right now. There were plenty in the past as well. And they were teams created by Games Workshop that a lot of the fans and players still have.
Yeah, that's it.
And it kind of goes the same for Necromunda, but because they've updated all the rules for Necromunda, it's not like you can just... You need to buy the gang books and things, and they're not being released. So, it's a bit of an interesting one. And we've been told that the Reaver and the Warhounds for Adeptus Titanicus, are essentially a month separated.
Yeah.
But what happens after that? After the 3rd month, you've now got all the models released. I'm assuming at some point we'll get the plastic separate the Warlord and the Knights. But if it's a 3 month release, what happens after that? Like, are we going to see Xenos added to it? Are we going to see, Chaos versions of those Knight kits and Titans released? And how far can you push this release? Like, is it a game that's one and done, or is it something that they're going to maintain long term? Who knows? So it's $490 that is a hard ask, in my opinion, to risk. So who knows? Maybe I'll be pleasantly surprised and be buying it soon. But
you won't be. Trust me. Oh dear.
And coming off the back of that announcement, we also got overnight, we're recording Monday, the Space Wolves versus Gene Silicott battle for Vigilis, I think is, I don't really
That's
know how to
I
say
that. That's how I
pronounce
that, yep.
So there's a YouTube video up there from Phil Kelly talking about the box game, which is cool. But most interestingly, it comes on the back of the Space Wolf Codex announcement as well, which means I think the article on Warhammer Community mentioned DICE as well. And obviously the cards and the collector's edition book, which is kind of cool. I don't really like the dice from the photo I've seen, because it's all scratch marks and claw marks for 2 through 5, and then it's got a wolf head for what I'm assuming is the 6, and then a skull with fangs for what I assume is 1. That's just going to be horrible to read in a game.
Do you think?
Yeah, it's going to suck. People are so used to reading pips that people complain about reading numbers, let alone scratches on a dice.
You think it's a bit gimmicky?
It is a bit. And the dice always sell well for them, so I'm not surprised, but... yeah, it's a funny one. The box looks pretty good. It looks like you're getting a campaign book of some description plus the quick start core rules. So it's not the full rule book from what I can see from the pictures. Who knows what the retail is? I'm assuming this will be, again, the mid-200s, but given Titanicus, who knows?
Yeah, but again, it's another release. That's...
But at least this is 40K, and they even talk about it in the article where the boxes, they're multi-part kits. They're not the snap fits, so you don't have to build them as Space Wolves if you don't want to build them as Space Wolves. They give you an upgrade spree for that. It's also going to be the release of the Gene Stellar Core Aberrants plastic box, which we haven't ever had. They were only available in Overkill as sort of snap fit models. It looks like it's a good value box. It'll be interesting to see how much it retails for.
Yeah, so we'll have to see what the value is when you see the price.
I do like this guy, though. There's a new HQ version character of the Aberrants called an Abominant, which is basically an Aberrant which trades out its psychic power and sneakiness for basically being an Ogryn. And it's waving around a power hammer, and it's got like 3 eyes and an extra face, and it's pretty creepy looking. I really love it. So hopefully that'll come out as a clan pack soon as well. He might not be subtle, but who needs to be when you've got a powered sledgehammer? That's kind of all you really need to know. And it also answers where you can build the Aberrants come with an option to build it with a, like it's pulled up a speed sign, like a road sign, and it's waving that around like a club. So I quite like the idea of painting a 60 sign or something on the... I did one a few years ago for Malifaux, for Killjoy, who... I had a cattle sign with a cow drawn on it that he was crushing.
I was going to say, then I think that board had a dead cow.
Yeah, yeah.
We had half a dead cow
that went with it, yeah.
Yep. So, as well as new releases and things being announced, last weekend we also saw War on the Wasteland, which happened down in Albany here in Western Australia, which is about 4 hours south of Perth.
Yeah, and if you've been following us for a little while now, you know we go down every year to do a 40K event. Mm-hmm. And Sam, who is sort of the...
Sam's the reason that we started going down there.
Yeah, well, that is true. He's not the head of the tabletop community down there, but he's certainly one who's been very pivotal in trying to bridge that gap between Perth and Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben, of course. The two guys organised to do this one. This is the second year, I think it is. Yeah. And it's a 30K weekend. So they had 24 players all in all down there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was probably 4 locals. So Sam and a couple of his mates in particular. And then we had, I think it was nearly 20 guys go down from Perth for the weekend. And a few of the guys took an opportunity to take some photos. One of them had a drone out. Another one hiked up one of the mountains at the end, on the Sunday before he drove home. So... it was essentially a Warhammer camp. They all went down Friday. They played Friday night and played Saturday. And then, all buggered off Sunday. So there's some photos which we'll try and put in the show notes, which included a photo of a Zone Mortalis game the guys played as a testament to how nutty they are.
Yeah, so they set up 2 rows and they were 16 feet long, each of the rows.
So it was essentially 64 of the Forge World tiles. So 16 long, 2 deep, and then
times
they had 2 of those to represent 2 spaceships that were sort of crossing, and they did a boarding action across the 2 ships. So looked pretty amazing. They had, I think it was like 10 or 11,000 points a side of infantry doing battle, and then they did some bigger games with Titans and things the following, I think that was the first night, that particular game.
Yeah, that
game.
Was the first night, yeah.
And then Titans and some other cool stuff on the second day.
I did like the comment, having to make some of these rules up on the fly.
Yeah. But look, it looked like a great weekend. It's just poorly timed for us because show is so close.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, Sam, please move it like earlier in the year, maybe June, July. That'd be great.
Purely to fit around. No, gosh, who wants to go down to Albany in June?
Well, it's friggin' freezing if you go down in winter, and they're there in like just off the peak of winter. So
I know. It's mad.
Yeah, they stay in we stay at the same venue. It's a scout hall, so there's scout dorms and bunks, and that's your lot. So
it's particularly breezy. It's a wooden scout hall.
Yeah, on stilts, lifted up.
A fair amount of holes in those walls and floor.
But yeah, it's a good weekend, and it looks like the boys had a good one this one just gone. So what we might do though is take a quick break, and we'll jump into today's Ask a TO question group from one of our local gamers. Right, so we've got four questions that were given to us by an attendee at one of our most recent events, and they've asked to remain nameless, so we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than just replying to them directly, we felt that it was a good opportunity for us to essentially answer the questions, and hopefully it's going to, I suppose, give us some transparency in how we make some of these calls and some of our thoughts on some of this stuff, because some of it is future-proofing. And their own, this person's own opinions as well. So
some of it, I think, potentially ties into some of the conversations that we've been having about, like you say, the future of 40K and
just competitive gaming
competitive
in general.
Gaming in general, whether that's in Western Australia or not. So his questions really are around standardisation.
Mostly, yeah. I mean, he prefaces the comments with a little sort of blurb.
He does. Okay. Have you ever given any thought or had any feedback in relation to making some aspects of tournaments a bit more regulated? Which is the same as saying it's about standardisation.
Well, that's true.
I've been thinking about this, and here are some examples that I can think. Here are some examples of this that I came up with.
So we've got four questions here. We're going to take them one at a time, and we're going to try and keep the responses to 5 to 10 minutes for each.
Let's aim for 5 and we'll probably hit 15. Okay, so question one. Having all deployment zones pre-marked on the boards, perhaps with thin white tape. This would mean that you wouldn't have any mistakes from players, perhaps measuring out their deployment zones incorrectly, allowing for possibly more fair setup. I'm not saying I saw this happen over the weekend, but it's one thing I thought of. Floppy tape measures do exist.
I get his argument for this, but of all the questions he asked, it's probably the least practical of any of the answers that we could possibly give. Or try and implement, because the problem you've got with, and we'll use 40K as the example, but it equally applies to essentially every other game system.
Mm.
Deployment zones, Warhammer has 6 different deployment zones that we'd have to mark out.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd end up with this mishmash cross of tape all over the boards, or you'd be having to try and retape boards mid-event, where you'd be stripping the boards, retaping the boards, and then putting the terrain back on.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply not a practical call. I know some of the old fat mats that used to, and we've got a few of them, some of them were very cleverly designed so that you had the inbuilt markings on there for
the grids.
Particularly the urban combat 1 and 2 were essentially set up so that you had the deployment zones marked within the artwork. And I suppose that's one potential way of doing it, but honestly, there are so many games out there these days that I can't see designers wanting to do something so centric around a game when it's not relevant for other games. And if it intrudes on the design and the aesthetic, then that's even worse. So
yeah, I think if it was just a matter of measuring out thin lines in one particular place. So most of the events that we run are 40K. Obviously, there's Age of Sigmar, and then we run a whole host for show. If it was just that case of measuring out one deployment zone, then there's perhaps some merit in it. But because that deployment zone can change 6 times over 6 games, it makes it a bit tricky.
The other factor you've got to consider is the actual board size itself. So if you're going to embed that information into any sort of map or anything like that, then you have to be playing on the same board for everything to make it work. You also have to then consider the fact that if the board or the surface that you're playing on, which has these markings on it, is even slightly out, then it throws the whole thing out.
Yeah.
And look, we had boards cut like we didn't cut them. I go and buy the wood, and the place where we get the wood from actually cuts it for us to the sizes that we guess. No, not guess.
We ask for.
We request. Yeah. But, you know, the board comes at, I think it's 2.4 metres. Yeah, 2.4 metres. So you go, oh, cool, I'll have four panels of 60, please.
Yeah.
But you don't get four panels of 60 because you lose so many millimetres per cut. So you've got three cuts. You actually lose nearly a centimetre off the entire length of it, which means you don't have 2,400 mils. You've got 2,390 mils, which means that you don't have 60 centimetre panels. You've got 59.5 or whatever, 59.7 panels. So for all intents and purposes, it is the right size. If you actually get technical, it's probably a few mil too short.
Mm.
So without with huge wastage for people buying those boards, like if you were willing to go, okay, I'm going to get one 6x4 out of this 24, then you could cut it the right size. But that's financially not practical for anyone who's trying to set up a club or you know, run events without the assistance of the rest of the gaming community. Because if you were buying 30 boards, you'd be buying 30 panels. Whereas if you can break it into four panels, then essentially for every three boards you buy, you're getting a fourth one out of it. So I think the pre-measured idea of deployment zones, I think War Machine does a little deployment zone, like they've got a few different scoring zones.
I was going to say, do they not use like a neoprene mat that goes on the edge and then so it's sort of pre-measured that way? Which could potentially be something that we look at, but
it just doesn't work when you're talking about a board that's 6 feet long. Because if you've got a deployment zone, say you're playing Hammer and Anvil, which is short edge to short edge, so you've got a deployment zone that is literally 4 feet across and 2 feet deep.
Yeah.
And you've got two of those, so you've got to lift all the terrain off, put those down, and then put all the terrain back on. And then at the end of that round, pull all the terrain off, take those mats off, put the new mats on, reset all the terrain. It's just, it's impractical, sadly. And I think part of... I get what he's saying, like standardizing that as a method of consistency would be great.
So maybe we'd be better off actually standardizing tape measures.
We're just getting people to check measurements and stuff. There's no harm in making sure what you're measuring is correct or what your opponents are doing is correct.
Mm.
So, it's a really tricky one and I get where he's going with it, but I don't think, at least for bigger battle games, not skirmish games, it's just not practical for battle games.
As far as standardizing tape measures, I guess I'm thinking if you used, I've never seen it, but if you used a dressmaking tape measure, you can stretch that.
You mean the like the rolly ones?
Yeah,
we do have a couple of players who've taken them before.
Oh, I've never seen them, but I know that you can stretch that. So I think that you'd kind of have to go, okay, it needs to be a metal tape measure and, you know, things like that.
I think what he's referring to there with that comment about... is it?
Oh, yeah, I know what he's referring to.
Yeah, it's being generous with your measurements more than it actually being a stretchy tape measure.
I know, but I'm saying that there is a possibility of having a stretchy tape measure.
Yeah.
So
it's a good idea, but the only way you could do it for 40K would be to remove the variable of deployment and make sure that every mission was the same deployment, which I don't think that's what we play it for. I think players like the idea of having a bit of variation and having to think on their feet and deciding those deployment zones and making them different is part of what makes the game interesting and fun. So I think standardizing it just down to a straight Dawn of War style deployment is actually a negative impact on the event at large. It might be better for consistency in the games, but I don't think it's good for the event.
And that variety might seamlessly lead us into our second question around terrain. It's great to see a variety of tables and themes at tournaments, but obviously some armies benefit greatly from large line of sights, where others would rather be able to get close to their enemy without being shot. Have you considered having terrain on tables as close to identical in setup as possible? Say 1 to 2 large pieces in the centre of the board of a similar size, with maybe a piece in each corner, also similar size, and a couple of walls spread throughout the rest of the field. I know this is probably quite unfeasible as it would require a chunk of financial investment to come up with near identical tables, but I feel like maybe if everyone could expect to have relative same type of battlefield for every match, there is an inadvertent favouritism for certain armies based purely off the table they randomly get for their match.
Well, let's talk about where else in the world has tried this. Obviously, the London GT infamously tried to make sure that everyone had the same terrain.
Mm-hmm.
the Frontline Gaming guys have got their own sets of terrain, which they've tried to not standardize across every table, but they're all reasonably similar. Mm. They're not necessarily deployed the same, but the tables feel relatively similar. And we saw at ETC, which you know, is another project we've started looking at as well, was a set of terrain that was reasonably modular and compact and durable that would allow you to essentially duplicate the same terrain again and again and again and again for, you know, not thousands of dollars.
Mm.
Part of, I think if we were going down the road of that sort of hyper-competitive e-sports style thing, then yes, there's a very strong argument for saying that, yes, we should be having some sort of standardization. But we're not, or at least not for the moment.
No, and for me, I guess the key word in that big sentence that I just read out was based purely off the table they randomly get for their match. And that key word is randomly.
Yeah, I mean, some of the countries and any of the ranked tournaments for ITC tend to do it where table one is, if you're winning, that's where you sit and you play on the same table again and again and again and again and again. If you're rank one, that's where you are.
Yeah.
Some players only do that for the final couple of rounds. Some events, I should say. I think...
And we don't do that.
No, ours are just randomly set up randomly. Assigned. Masters, we tend to make sure we know where the top table is because we like to film that if we can. But, yeah, I think part of the value for 40K for me, I suppose, is that random factor is a good thing on what table you get because it forces you to adapt. It forces you to take other considerations into where you deploy and all the rest of it. If you're playing on the same table for six games over a two-day tournament, for me, that'd really frustrate me because you end up in a situation where you're not having to adapt, you're not having to learn and respond to another variable. You can, if you know going in exactly what the terrain is going to be, you build an army to go with that.
Mm.
And it's another way of, I suppose, countering.
It's teaching to the test.
Yeah, that's actually a really good example. Really, you know, it's. I don't necessarily think it's good for the average tournament to do that. Like for the, you know, London GT or for LVO or for ETC, it might work really well for those really high-end, hyper-competitive events where you do want to have that sort of consistent result. But to be honest, it'd actually be a put-off for me going because I like going and playing on different tables. Now, the Frontline Gaming guys do a great job with LVO, and the six tables, nine tables I played on were each different and similar in some way. And I think that's the balance. The photos I saw from ETC still felt really light in terms of terrain. We aim for between 25 and 33% coverage of a board in terrain. And that's...
We do seem to have significantly higher than that on our city boards.
Yeah, but when you actually measure it all out, it's not.
Did we drop it down? I know that we had a lot more. I know it was about 50% on city boards, but I'm just thinking... Actually, I seem to remember redistributing that because it was too terrain heavy.
No, I mean, the city ones have always been a little bit fuller than the other tables, but...
They also feel fuller because the terrain is so much higher.
Yeah, and I think line of sight's way more important now in 8th than it has been in terms of 40K for a number of years. So the new terrain Games Workshop's releasing tends to be bigger and taller and you know, give you more advantages
but
in regards to line of sight.
The new stuff doesn't.
But that's what literally I was about to go to, is the problem is they've got windows and everything. So
yeah.
It's actually just as hard to get line of sight blocking out of their terrain as any of the older stuff because you're having to block up windows or make house rules that you can't shoot through those windows on the ground floors, which is what ITC does.
And I know that that's something that you were going to talk about, the new terrain that you've got, but I'm just going to drop this in there now. I'm actually quite surprised by the new terrain, that they do have so many windows. Given that they have the line of sight rules in there and it's so important for 8th edition, I was really surprised to see that those windows are open.
Yeah, and there's not one panel that I've seen so far that is full floor to ceiling.
No, and I actually find it really frustrating. As a TO who has to build these this terrain and paint this terrain, I find it really frustrating that I have to purchase their terrain and then modify it to make it work for their gaming system.
See, part of me thinks, though, that that's... more of a player expectation than what Games Workshop think, because if they're selling this terrain, is that their way of saying, no, this is the way we intend the game to be played, and you guys are all the ones who are
doing it wrong,
changing the expectations. And I think that's almost a more valid counter-argument to you guys don't know your own game. And while there is an argument for that in terms of...
I wasn't saying they don't know their own game.
But in terms of competitive...
I suppose it was, actually.
In terms of like high-end competitive play, they may not have their finger on the pulse as much as they potentially could or should have. But is it a situation where they're going, no, we've got this train because this is how we think the game should be played? Yeah.
Back to the original question around standardizing the terrain. I can see an argument for it, but I also can see an argument for that. For us building terrain, it's going to be boring if we have to build every single table looking the same. But for players playing on it, we're aiming to give variety.
Yeah, that's always been the intent, is to try and provide you with a visually interesting exercise in the gaming. And you know, you're obviously getting different opponents each round, and at what point do you stop standardization? Because it's a very slippery slope where you start going, okay, well, everyone's going to get the same tables with the same deployment zones with the same terrain. Mm-hmm. Well, now it's not fair because my army doesn't shoot as well as yours, so we're going to standardize this and we're going to standardize that, and we fast approach chess.
Exactly, and the whole thing with this game is that, I mean, we do have some people complaining that there's not enough line of sight blocking on our tables, despite the fact that we've
boarded up windows and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, made significant effort to make sure that we do have line of sight blockers. But I think that you kind of have to take the punt that there are going to be some tables that your army is going to work really well on and some tables that it's not going to work well on.
Mm.
And if we did standardize it, would we lose the diversity in armies?
Look, it's definitely a possibility. If you can bank on a certain type of terrain and volume of terrain... like I know there were a couple of the ETC games where, because of the volume of terrain and the type of terrain, nothing happened.
Mm.
Like they were 20-0 losses or 20-0 wins because they went, oh, if I come out, I get shot.
But
if you come out,
hiding.
I'm going to sit over here and do nothing. Your turn. Oh, your turn. No, your turn. Your turn. Oh, cool. My last turn. Cool. I jump on all the objectives and win. Mm. I think.
So in which case, it's not about who goes first. It's about who goes last.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think There's definitely merit for having something consistent in the way it's deployed, but that also then leads to making sure that the terrain is vaguely similar to make sure it's deployed evenly. And half the fun and difficulty for me is, learning and adapting on the fly to what you're given. But, you know, we have started wandering down that road of looking at some of the more standardized setups that are possible and how financially viable those are, because, as this person mentions, terrain isn't cheap.
No,
and
it's really, really not.
You know, looking back at the London GT, he tried to do it cheaply and cheerfully in just raw foam, essentially. Mm. And even that would take days of work to get them even remotely standardized, ignoring actually buying the foam, which foam is relatively cheap, but it's not free. You're still spending money there to get that foam. The next step up is going to MDF or PVC plastics type stuff where it's... you know, basic shapes, laser cut, and you sort of snap it together or click it together and either paint it or have it pre-coloured. And now we're getting more expensive, but again, you can pack it down and it's, you know, a bit more flexible in that regard and you can get consistency. But someone still has to handle it and manage it and build it. And if you're packing it down, you have to put it back together again.
Yeah, and remember how it goes back together.
Yeah, so there are definitely...
Who keeps hold of the Lego instructions?
There are definitely some hurdles with standardizing terrain. And if you're not going to pull it apart and you're going to keep it all built, then you have to be able to store it.
Yeah.
We've got 30, 70-litre plastic tubs worth of terrain sat in our in the Obsec dungeon here at home, plus all the boards.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking up what essentially amounts to a 3-metre by 3-metre space.
3-metre by 3-metre by 3-metre high space.
Yeah. It's not... And there's boards there as well, obviously, but...
Mm.
It's not compact. It's not easy to store.
Mm-mm.
So you've got different hurdles for different things and you've got to try and find the happy medium that your players will respond to. And certainly...
I think different players have different expectations. Yeah. So I've spoken before about the response to the London GT with some people going, I didn't come here for the terrain. I came here to play a game. I don't care what I'm playing on. Doesn't matter. And other people who are...
horrified.
Yeah. And everyone's got different opinions.
Yeah, so could we standardize the terrain? Probably. But is it necessarily good for the events that we run and the culture of the attendees that we have is another matter entirely. Mm. And it's a question that would need to be carefully considered and balanced on, yeah, what we see now.
And something that we've mentioned before is that this game does rely on an element of luck and chance. And one of those elements of chance is the board that you're going to get.
Yeah.
So I think the same as the element of chance with the dice roll, what I like about the different terrain is that you have to build an army that can be as flexible and fluid as possible based on not knowing what board you're going to get, what army you're going to play against, what the deployment zone's going to be, what the mission's going to be.
And these are just our opinions, of course. Yeah. I mean,
but we're the ones organising the event.
Well, that is true.
No, these are just our opinions.
And there's nothing wrong with having ones contrary to ours and still coming to our events.
No.
But I suppose at least if we explain this to you now, then, you know, there's more room for us to kind of go, well, this is the thought processes. Mm. And like I say, we have started investigating the potential of having some of the standardised styles of terrain. It won't happen this year. But,
no, it won't.
It's one that we're investigating to see how viable it is financially speaking and what sort of investment is required.
But I guess share your opinions with us, because before we go down the road of making 100 tables to be standardised, let us know what you think about having a variety of terrain versus having standardised sets.
Would that put you off an event? Would you rather go to an event where every table was the same or at least 80% comparable? It'd be great to find out what the community thinks.
Hmm.
Question three.
Next question. Similar to terrain, has there ever been consideration given to having objectives in preset locations for each mission?
Now, this is something that's done heavily at ITC. All the ITC missions, the Champions missions at least, have prefixed mission objectives. And I know there's been a couple of events here in Perth that have tried it as well, with fixed deployment of objectives. I think part of the experiment for figuring out whether this is good or bad for the events is to do with what they've just done at ETC, which is what we're going to see happen at ATC and with the singles events at show.
I've just realised that apparently Australia is one of the only places in the world that makes everything an acronym. And my goodness, we use a lot of acronyms and shortenings and that kind of thing.
So the normal sequence for 40K is when you roll to deploy the when you deploy the objectives, the person who puts the last one then gets to pick their side.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know that you're picking if you're putting the last objective down, you can automatically in your head pick the side as you're deploying objectives to favour where the objectives land for your own deployment.
Mm.
The ETC this year and the ATC and then by extension the events at show have removed that and said once the objectives are down, roll for sides.
Yeah.
And I think that'll probably address the balance in that. And I think there's then an argument, if that works the way I think it's going to, you would then have an argument to say, no, we might as well just standardize deployment of objectives at that point. But there is a level of tactical acumen required with deploying your objectives because you can start setting up your ways of scoring later in the game. And I think it's another level of thought that you can put into your pre-game stuff for 40K if you are randomly deploying objectives. How you set up, there was a great deployment of a diamond of objectives in the last edition of the game, which doesn't really happen as much this time. But you could set up essentially a diamond of four objectives, have like a decent castle that sits roughly in the middle of that diamond and then protects all four but doesn't claim anything until late game.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those strategies seem to get lost with people who just kind of chuck objectives down on the table. And if they're spread evenly across the table, which is, I think, what most of the ITC missions do, you know that in advance.
I think this is sometimes the difference between some of our newer players and veteran players, and one of the reasons why we're seeing veteran players' games take a lot longer.
Mm.
Because I think with the newer players, they're just not able to think on so many levels at the same time. So you do tend to get newer players just chucking an objective down, whereas the veteran players are actually really going through and systematically thinking about everything.
One of our friends, Brett, he, when we went to ETC, had this spreadsheet set up that had how he was going to deploy with each mission, where he was going to put his objectives down for each mission, and how best to score those points each round. Like, it was all pre-planned, and it's stuff that you can do to a degree, because you know how many objectives each mission has, you know how many you're going to be allowed to put down, and then you can adjust your plan. Like, if your opponent puts one down where you were going to, then obviously you've got an advantage there. So I think objective placement's an art that will certainly win veteran players games, but it's not one that's considered by most tournament goers. So the idea of fixed objectives seems really appealing, because, and it also does cut down a lot of the time pre-game. If you know the objectives go in those six spots, then you don't have to worry about that at the start of the game, and you move.
Yeah.
You know, you save yourself 2 to 5 minutes.
And a lot of game systems do that.
Yeah.
With, you know, certain missions have the, you know, this particular deployment zone, and these are where your objectives are placed.
Yeah. But I think if you're standardizing either the terrain or the objectives, you actually are better off doing both. Because the second that you have fixed terrain but random objectives, you can manipulate the start of the game with that when you deploy objectives, if you know what I mean. So you can hide.
I don't.
So if you know how the maps are going to be deployed, and you know which buildings are where, and you know how the map's laid out, then there's obviously going to be advantageous positions for you to put objectives if you're able to place them where you want them. So you can't have free deployment of objectives, because then there's nothing stopping people putting it on the third floor of a building. Out of, you know, like, it essentially creates a stalemate game very easily by careful placement of objectives. So I think if you're going to standardize the terrain, you actually want to standardize the objectives, because it would stop a lot of those manipulations. Whereas with random boards and random objectives, you get the opposite effect. So I feel like they're kind of intertwined to some degree.
I'm just thinking more about the, I know that we've moved on, but thinking again about that standardizing of terrain. And I think that one of the things that I hear a lot is about the creativity and that goes into
the hobby.
And I really feel that by standardizing everything, we're getting to the point where we're taking away all of that creativity.
Well, you're taking away why you're doing it in the first place. Or at least you would be to me.
It does feel as though we're moving towards a game of chess. It's just a really expensive game of chess.
Look, there is a place for those sorts of events, don't get me wrong. But I think that having variation is actually good for most game systems, because it gives you a level of replayability where each game is going to be different. And if you're playing the same missions with the same deployment zones on the same tables game after game after game, it starts losing any sort of specialness. Doing it for like a hyper-competitive event that you attend once a year is completely valid.
But doing it for 10 events?
I mean, for Masters, I'd probably consider fixed objectives.
Fixed objectives. I thought you were going to say fixed terrain. Not for this year, no. Right?
And it might be something we try for Masters this year. Who knows?
Have we written the players pack already?
No, because of show.
Awesome. Then, yeah, it might be something we try.
But, I think the simple statement of we'll just make them fixed objectives has far greater connotations to players than you might first think. Certainly the high-end players it'll change the game. And whether that's a good thing or not, I still don't know.
No, and I'm interested to hear what other people's thoughts are
on
that, as well as the terrain. And then the last one is, I guess it's around, you know, if you're in a poker tournament.
Yep.
Obviously, the deck of cards is wrapped in plastic and it's unwrapped in front of the judges, and you know that it is a standard deck of cards.
Yep.
So this is around checking people's tactical objective decks and the possibility at the moment that people can, I guess, stack their decks in an advantageous way. So whether, if you're saying that it has to be the generic cards only, people putting in army-specific cards into their deck or adding in extra cards that come from that generic deck, but having two or three of the card that could be advantageous for them put in that deck? And would we at any stage consider checking the decks beforehand? So I believe there's 36 cards in the basic set.
Yep.
At the beginning of an event, when players come and register, going through and making sure that they have those 36 cards and only those 36 cards.
I actually think that's the most pointless thing I could think of.
I don't think it's pointless. I can see...
If someone actually wants to cheat that system, it's the easiest system in the world to cheat.
Yes. but I don't think that suggesting that checking it is pointless. But
I think checking it is pointless. Not suggesting it is a possibility is pointless.
So why do you think I'm certainly not advocating for checking it, because I just think, okay, say for doubles we had 68 players in there. If it took us a minute to check every player's pack, that's over an hour just checking deck. It wouldn't take over a minute. And, you know, it might take 2 minutes to do each deck, 2 hours checking decks, yet to a point where, you know, do you have to do like a boxing weigh-in and they've all got to come the night before and have their decks checked and their armies checked and their dice weighed and that kind of thing. And whether or not we get to that point, if it does head more down that,
If a professional sports, I could easily see it being done.
Yeah.
But I think the average tournament... Well, first of all, there are parts of the world that don't play Maelstrom, namely America. It's unheard of a lot of the time to play Maelstrom missions, whereas the Europeans and the Australians tend to use it more.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you get to use your Codex cards or your stock deck of cards is another up for conversation. We tend to allow the Codex-specific ones for friendly fun events like First Blood...
Last Blood,
like doubles, because they are meant to be hobby-focused events, so you can do all the cool, weird things.
We had basic only for doubles, didn't we?
Yes, we did, but that was only because, it's an intro side of things, where the year before we allowed Codex ones. The idea with checking the decks, if someone honestly wants to cheat that, it's really easy to do.
To slip extra in after they've been checked?
Yeah, like literally you could go down there with two boxes of the standard deck.
I guess the difference
hand
there...
Hand one over to the judges and then take the other to the table. Like there's...
The difference there would be that is... I guess that's deliberate cheating as opposed to just making a mistake.
So you, but then the problem is at that point though that you still have to be able to catch them out. So you as an opponent, if you're manipulating the cards, whether it's a modified deck or whether you're sliding stuff in on the fly... Me as your opponent, I still have to be able to tell you that you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So if people are using the wrong cards... Now, I know there were guys at the doubles event using the Codex cards, but the only difference with Codex cards and the standard cards is the first six cards. Cards numbered 11 through to 16. Because it's a D66 roll.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys who I knew were using Codex cards as I moved around the room, I told them, if you draw the 11 card, no matter what it says on the card... It's the 11 card from the standard deck. So by using that, that 11 card from the Codex deck as a standard card, it's a pretty... At least you still got the convenience of drawing the cards. They're the only six cards that'll be different. And the fact that objectives 11 through 16 are literally exactly the same as 21 through 26, there's going to be no confusion over what those cards actually mean. Now... One of the common practices I have when I use the Maelstrom deck with my opponents is basically handing them my deck and going, do you want to cut the deck? Do you want to shuffle the deck? How do you, so that there's a layer of transparency in regards to me not having loaded the deck with the cards I want at the top of it or anything else like that. And I often will ask, or generally, once I hand my deck over and go, hey, do you want to cut the deck? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that?
Then your opponent feels compelled to do
the
same. The
opponent generally does the same. And again, it's not about trust, it's about transparency, so that you're...
Do you have people who will cut the deck and shuffle it?
Yeah, yeah. And I take no offence at that, because some players go, no, that's fine, man, and I'll just stand there and shuffle it in front of them.
Yeah.
But I feel like the opportunity to manipulate the cards is one that, anyone with a decent sleight of hand could probably do, or blatantly do it before the game. So offering my deck to my opponents and going, hey, do you want to cut and shuffle the deck... alleviates any of those potential concerns. Now, if I were loading the deck with extra cards, is there any value in me getting them to do that, to then have them, shuffle and cut it? Maybe, if you get the right cards out. But again, at the higher end of the competitive, if we're scoring cards, I keep track of what my opponent's scoring. Not because I'm checking to make sure their deck's right, but to make sure that how I know how many points you're scoring and what they're scoring for. Because if I know that, my Warlord's still on the table, but I haven't seen you play Kingslayer yet, it's not in your hand, it's not in the... You haven't discarded it and it's not been scored. Well, there's a Kingslayer still up for grabs there at that point. So you start almost card counting to a degree so that you know what your opponent's scoring, what they potentially still have to come. And if you know you're drawing three cards a turn and you can score 3 cards a turn, then you're only getting 18 of the 36 cards for that 6-turn game. So, you know, you start, you know, manipulating the deck actually becomes really almost pointless, because unless you're willing to stack and load the deck in your favor for the draw rather than what's in the deck, you almost never go through a full deck anyway.
No, but I guess if you have, say you have one card which is great for your army.
Yeah.
And you put 6 of those in your deck, you got a much higher possibility of pulling one out.
Yeah. But like I say, they're all the cards are numbered as well. So if say card 45 was really good for your army, and I don't know what that is off the top of my head.
Why not?
Because I'm good, but I'm not that good.
Right. I'm modest too.
I know what half the deck is.
Anyway, card number 45.
You pulled that one out. It's numbered 45. Mm-hmm. And if you go, say it's Scour the Skies, and I don't think that's what the number is, but it
doesn't matter.
And you play Scour the Skies and you kill a unit with fly. And then you go, I'm scoring Scour the Skies again. Well, there's that sort of inbuilt level of short-term memory that all humans have where you go, you've scored Scour the Skies already. How have you got 2 of those? The secure objective ones I could see being duplicated, because like I say, 11 through 16 and 21 through 26 are already duplicated. They're already secure objective 1 through 6 on both those decks. And then 31 through 36 is defend objectives 1 through 6. Yeah. So I could easily see people scoring multiple objective 1s, because you can already score objective 1 three times out of the deck already. Yeah. So I think there's a small level of opportunity there. But again, if you're not sure, there's no harm in saying, hey man, which cards have you scored? I think there's got to be a level of responsibility for the players as much as checking on each other. And you know, if you've got any of those concerns, then bringing it up with the TO. The other one that I've done in the past is shuffle the deck in front of my opponent. A really good way of doing it is to get the 36 cards and put them into 6 piles of 6.
Mm.
Face down, so you can't see what you're putting in each pile.
Yeah.
But if you go, cool, 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-2-2-2-2-3-3-3, and count them out, then your opponent has no question in their mind that you've at least got only 36 cards. So if at the end of the game you've scored objective 1 4 times, and I know that you've only got 36 cards, then there's a problem. More often than not, though, at our events in the past, we've had players with the opposite issue, where they've got to the end of the game and realized that a 36-card deck was 42 cards. And it's like their opponent only had, you know, 8 cards because the decks have been mixed up. And then they come and tell you that, and you go, well, how do we fix that?
Hmm.
And they're all the time. Like, the TO box always has at least one singular Maelstrom card. Sometimes it's a deck-specific one, like it's a branded, like a Death Guard one or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, people's Maelstrom decks are always something that are a potential failure point for consistency in play. And it's one of the things that ITC has avoided, because they don't do it. They've got their own little objective process anyway.
I think if we move towards a more competitive game where there was, you know, significant amount of money on the line, then, you know, maybe we would increase the entry fee and it would have to include a new pack of Maelstrom cards.
Yeah.
And similar to the, you know, with poker, it has to be opened on the day and that kind of thing. But really, I can't... And even with that, you can still slide things in, unless, of course, you go to everything's branded and, you know, it's branded with that particular event name and that particular event date, so you can't slide extra cards in there. But really, I can't see any other way that we can standardise that. Or,
and the problem with that is, of course, that means that players by the end of the year, coming, if you came to every one of our 40K events, by the end of the year, you'd have like 10 frigging decks of it.
Yeah.
And you'd be
Which would be great, because between them, you should be able to make one full deck after you've lost a card at every event.
But you're also, as a player, paying for that every time.
Yeah, I know.
Which is just...
No, I know.
You know, it's...
And awesome. When you look at cards like in Vegas for the playing cards, it's $1. But
yeah.
Maelstrom cards, when you're buying them from Games Workshop, are significantly more than $1.
Well, if we were going and saying, okay, we want to print, we'll use the last event as an example, 68 decks of 36 cards.
Mm-hmm.
You go, oh, you know, that's, I can't even do the maths off the top of my head how many cards that is.
No idea.
What's that? 6, 12, 18, no.
I'm not sure as it matters.
It's probably a couple of thousand cards.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot until you realize it's really not. Like for a printer, it's actually not worth doing because you can't get that done via like a business card because each card has to be different.
Different, yeah.
So you're having to actually set up playing cards. And for a printer, so it's 2,500 cards.
2,500, yeah.
So because of the way it'd be set up for a printer, there's actually not a lot of like viability in doing, because that's a small print run for a, mm-hmm. what would be a traditional press. So your actual cost of producing those decks is probably going to be
close to what they're paying,
$15 a deck. Yeah. And that's being optimistic. It could be easily worse than that. And then you go, well, okay, I won't get it printed professionally. I'll do it myself. Well, the amount of time and effort to do that would just be horrific. So there's no good answer to that. At that point, you probably are just better off buying a bunch of them from a third party, like a local gaming store that'll give you 10 or 20% off the cards.
Except with that, obviously, then you can slip whatever you want in without
exactly.
it. Yeah.
So
the thing is, I guess, it's trust. Why are you coming to events?
Yeah.
Are you coming to win by cheating? Like, is particularly at the moment with events, you are playing for, with our events, you're playing for a little round medallion.
And, you know, the odd box set here and there and bragging rights, basically.
It's bragging rights. Is it worth cheating for the sake of bragging rights?
Well, this is one of the concerns which kind of leads into the tail end of this topic with standardization and with, moving the game towards those sorts of esports style prizes. We've just seen CanCon announce that the winner of the Australian ITC rankings, assuming they go to CanCon,
mm-hmm.
will get an all expenses paid trip to LVO 2019.
Yeah.
And we've seen EastCon in Victoria say that they're going to give the winner $400 worth of travel vouchers and a free ticket to CanCon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were talking about doing something similar and working with some of the other major TOs around the country to kind of share the love and bring players around the country to different events. But is that going to change, you know, the playing field for players as such, who then start becoming more competitive because now there is something on the line?
It changes things for us as well, because it does mean that we have to charge a higher amount for tickets because we've now got to pay for a gaming license.
Yeah.
So whereas at the moment when you, they don't have to license bragging rights, so we're okay with that.
It's like if a single prize is $300 or more or something, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to have a license.
At least here in Western Australia. It's probably a national law, actually, rather than state-based.
Well, we actually go under the West Australian Department of Racing and Liquor and Gaming.
So I don't know what it'd be on the East Coast.
It's Racing, Gaming and Liquor, sorry. Doesn't matter, though. But yeah, it is, you know, I'm sure it is fairly
relatively
standard
comparable
across the country.
Yeah.
But that's for us, there's a difference. But I certainly think that for players, once you start putting a monetary value on it, we are going to see changes to the whole environment.
Yeah. And some of them will be good, but some of them won't be.
Mm.
So we'll probably try it out, but how that looks and what that looks like at the moment is, you know, still to be decided.
Yeah.
But I think if in 10 years' time we are playing in that sort of esports style format, then yeah, I would be expecting a standardized layout of maps. I'd be expecting a standardized layout of objectives. And I think that league, that high-end league, would certainly be much more formalized and controlled. The counter-argument to that when you start looking at professional sports is you could say, okay, well, American football is played on the same size field every single time. So it doesn't matter where they go in the country.
Yeah, but they're all playing with the same ball and the same number of players.
Yep. And also there's still variations in weather and temperature and time of day and all the rest of it. Then you've got other competitive sports like motor racing, where you look at Formula One, the world championships across an entire circuit of a dozen tracks, and not one of them is identical to the next.
And they're not racing in the same car.
No,
either.
Exactly. And I actually think the tabletop gaming experience is more comparable to motorsport.
Yeah, definitely.
For that reason.
Yeah.
You know, playing cricket or football or any of those ones where you've got basically the same, your only variance is the player skill.
Mm.
In motorsport, you've got one driver using a tool that is probably different to every other driver,
mm-hmm.
on a different track every time.
Mm.
And when you talk about that and replace the track with table and with car with army.
I guess the difference...
It's pretty comparable.
I guess the difference is, though, that you know in advance the track and the circuit, and they can make tweaks to their car.
And they can learn the circuits, yeah.
That's it. Whereas we don't... Nobody knows in advance what table they'll be playing on.
Oh,
because
we
don't know in advance what table they'll be playing on. Because it's not until the morning that somebody works out where to put the terrain.
No, so maybe some sort of level of mid-standardization is where it needs to end up, where you've got different types of standard terrain, or 10 different types of standard terrain, and you turn up to an event and there's 60 tables
and
10 of each. And that way you can know that there are six possibilities, not essentially 60.
We actually have that to some degree. You know, we've got two alien tables which are very similar. We've got a couple of city boards which are very similar. We've got, you know, so
yeah.
We've got that to some degree.
Not to the volume that standardization would be, though.
No.
So, yeah.
I could probably get on board with that.
Yeah, I think there's a nice happy medium there that potentially could exist. But... Again, financially speaking, you'd have to try and figure out how to do that.
It's not going to happen this week, that's for sure.
So that's kind of our answers to those four questions. And I know that there's probably plenty of conversation that could go in and around those four questions on top of what we've already said today. But we have managed to keep this down to about 45 minutes. So we're going to leave the topic there for today. And we'll be back to wrap up the episode in just a second. So that's our first Ask a TO episode done. If you have any questions you would like us to answer, you've got an idea of some of the questions we've already had off today's episode and some of the detail that goes into those questions would be really good because it starts giving us your point of view that we can start the conversation with. I've already had one question which we had on the live stream from Tim Hales last week.
Oh, yes.
That'll probably go into a future one of these episodes that we touched on for 30 seconds on the live stream and then moved on because it's a complex topic.
It was a really tricky question.
It
wasn't a tricky question, but there's a lot that goes in behind it.
Yeah, so if you guys have questions that you'd like us to answer from a TO's perspective that you know, maybe just you're in another part of the world and you want to hear what you think of it as Aussies, if you're a local attendee of a tournament and you want to ask us a question that you've always had in the back of your head but never got around to asking, send them through. You can do it via the Facebook page. You can do it via email. You can hit the Contact Us button on the website. There's a few different ways you can send them through.
Text messages, braille, smoke signals.
No. Don't give them more options. Just confuse them. Send them through so we can add them to another topic and we'll do another one of these episodes when we've got sort of four or five questions, depending on how complex they are. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the four questions we got today. What do you feel about standardized deployment zones, standardized terrain, standardized objectives, and checking cards for Maelstrom?
I just realized standardized is one of those things that just really pushes my buttons. I'm so not into standardization. And I just, yeah, just as you kept saying standardized, I feel my eye starting to twitch. No standardization.
She hasn't had a coffee today, people.
She doesn't drink coffee.
Does sometimes.
Not for a very long time. Anyway.
So, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the four questions we tried to answer today. And if you've got any of your own, send them through. We're more than happy to chat about them on air.
I think you've covered that.
Yeah. Before we go, though, I wanted to touch on very quickly the new Warhammer Sectum Imperialis terrain kits, which we kind of mentioned in passing in the topic.
Yes.
We picked up two of them, the Sanctum box and the Ruins box. Now, the Ruins...
Did we?
Yes.
Yes. We picked them up and snuck them into the house, hoping that one of the we wouldn't notice. And now we are talking about it.
Well, we've had them sat on the table here where the other we could have seen them for weeks.
Yeah.
Anyway, the little Ruins box, just more of a piece of public service announcement more than anything. That little Ruins box, it's the cheapest of them currently available. I'd probably give it a miss if you're going to go and look at buying this terrain, only because you get half of the sprues in that box in the Sanctum box. And the Sanctum box is one of the mid-tier boxes. It's not the super expensive ones, but it's not the cheap ones either. And it feels like, because you're not getting full wall panels and you're not getting any flooring in the Ruins box either, there's just less use for it on the table because you're essentially just putting up little corner sections and, you're still having to block up windows and all that other sort of stuff. It doesn't feel like it adds a lot to a table of titans and knights and big tanks and that sort of stuff. It's going to help for infantry to get a cover save, and that's about it.
Yeah, so this is Mike's public service announcement. You heard it here first. Don't buy the little cheap one. Buy the more expensive one. It's better value for money in the long run.
Well, it, if I were being paid to say that, that'd be fine. But as a gamer for my hobby budget, I wouldn't personally, if I were going to build a table, I wouldn't, now knowing this, I wouldn't go and buy that Ruins box. I'd go and buy the bigger boxes because you're getting a better value for money. That is true. But you're also getting more useful stuff out of those boxes more than anything else. The Sanctum one that we've got here is the one that's, it comes with three little statues that stand on plinths that run alongside the building, which is actually quite a big terrain piece from what I can tell. But
he's saying from what he can tell, because so far he's managed to clip them off the sprues.
Like, you can see how many panels you get and how different builds and stuff. So it's going to cover a fair amount of space. And then when you stack the ruin stuff on top of it, it might actually add more to it.
I'm not sure if we will stack the ruin stuff on top or if we'll just put a base on the ruins and so that it does actually become usable.
I think there's plenty of modularity available for these kits, so we'll see what happens with them.
By that, we'll argue about it off air. Yeah. And unfortunately, he's the one that glues everything. Because
you can't be trusted,
glue. With super glue. And this is plastic glue, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, I've sort of half-assembled parts of this, and this is the first piece of Games Workshop terrain that I've built in a long time with plastic glue.
No, you didn't have to add with plastic glue. That was redundant.
It was. I built the Militarum, the Sector Mechanica stuff. That's all in there.
You built half of it.
That's all plastic. No, that's super glue, I think.
It is super glue, yeah.
Whereas this stuff seems to be responding with the plastic glue this time, which is great.
See, and I can be trusted with plastic glue because I can't stick your fingers together with plastic glue.
All right, guys. Well, that's the end for another episode. If you want to get in touch, all the usual options are there. Otherwise, we'll see you in the next episode. You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.